Segundo here, and I'm feeling a bit underwhelmed by Kate Atkinson's new novel. You see, I figured that One Good Turn was a bit of a clue, a book describing certain positions which I am unfamiliar with, but it was nothing of the sort. So instead, I must rely upon Cinemax offerings for my continuing education along these lines on the female form, as well as the male form, but I won't get into that, because, you know, it's all about geometrical perfection. A little bit of the goatsy go, if you catch my sly reference to square dancing, if you know what I mean. I read up on the subject. I am very familiar with what goes down in certain private settings. So Miss Atkinson is hopeless. But if you know of a good book on the subject I am speaking on, if you really know what I am talking about, I urge you to drop me a line.
So I am here with Kate Atkinson, author of Case Histories, and most recently, One Good Turn. In fact, we just had a Kate Atkinson-like moment here involving a cup of tea. So, Kate, how are you doing under the circumstances?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Well, first off, I wanted to actually kind of ask you about sort of the natural flow of One Good Turn and also Case Histories to some degree. Sometimes, you know, a writer such as Francine Prose will have this feel of spontaneity where she'll, you know, labor upon the book for 5 years, and yet you worked on this book for 2 years. I'm wondering if you're the kind of writer who sort of finds the flow as you write the actual book, or how much of One Good Turn was planned and how much of it was sort of, you know, you discovered it as you actually wrote the book?
No, none of it was planned. I don't really plan.
Okay.
I know where I want to start, and I think I know where I want to end, and then it's a bit in between. But I think the first 100 pages takes probably 10 times as long as the last 100 pages, if not more, because that's when you're finding your way, and that's the really difficult bit. So, and I rewrite endlessly. I mean, for the first 100 pages, I will go back to page one every single day and start rewriting. And that seems to be the way that I get the feeling of whatever it is, the atmosphere, the voice, or and start the characters off. So it seems to be pretty regular. Around about 100, 103, I start moving forward. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, whatever, a couple of hundred pages of really hard work. And then the last 100 pages is just a breeze. You know?
Really?
It just flies by then.
Okay.
Because you know where you're going by the last 100 pages, more or less. I mean, you may not know exactly what's going to happen, but you certainly know enough to know that what kind of a structure you have and how near you are to the end, I think.
Huh. Now, is close omniscient voice, which you really use for the perspective on this, is this something that is what you really sort of revise your book about in terms of like really getting that precise kind of moment? It's almost as if the perspective itself sort of reveals all about these characters and pretty much says all. How do you actually work to kind of hone? When do you feel that a moment is absolutely right?
I don't know. Well, when you don't want to rewrite it anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, but sometimes, you know, there's a writer called Anne Fine. I think she's the children's laureate in Britain, and I heard her once on the radio years ago, and the interviewer was saying, oh, you know, you must, you know, write so much every day, Miss Fine, it must be so wonderful. And she said, you know, a good day is a good sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's my kind of rule of thumb, that they're not all going to be good and they're not all going to be unique, but there's going to be one sentence in there that you think, that's good. And I really like the good sentences are what stitches everything together, because you know you're not going to write it better than that, and that nobody's ever written it before, and you like it, and
yeah,
that's the important thing, I think. But the point at which you leave it is just the point at which you leave it. It's hard to explain how you know that that's enough,
really?
I think.
I mean, because there's also sort of this sort of arch exuberance that runs throughout the course, particularly of these last two books. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you know when, like, for example, something like Louise pining for sort of faceless, emotionless sort of sex, when do you know that something like that is actually right? Or when do you, is it just a sort of instinctive process for you?
Oh, I don't think about what I'm writing when I'm writing. I immediately contradict myself by saying I'm thinking about the writing, but because all of those characters, like Case Histories, I suddenly discovered the internal monologue. I don't know where it had been all my life, but I suddenly got the hang of absolutely getting inside the head of a character. So that once you understand that character, and once you're inside their head, that's it. You don't have to think so much about what a character is going to do or think or where they're going to go or how they're going to feel because you know. And therefore, it's a much more instinctive kind of writing. It's much easier, too, because you don't need to bother so much with grammar and correctness because we don't think correctly. So sure. People can be very halting and confused within that character. And so that just... you know it, so it just goes.
So it's interesting because in behind the scenes of a museum, there you have a kind of footnote sort of process of this kind of internal monologue. And I guess, was it the actual mystery genre of case histories that kind of got you sort of thinking about containing these internal monologues within the actual prose itself? Or?
No, I think I started off wanting to do the internal monologues and then worked out how to fit that into whatever... You know, because it's, for me, they're not crime novels. They're much more character driven. So the plot's not incidental because I like plot, but they were very much formed by the characters, I think. Sure. So for me, those behind the scenes and the novels that follow that, although they look like they might be internal monologues, to me they're not because I felt much more, I think, outside of those. Characters, whereas I've sort of learnt the trick of, it's a bit like being a spiritualist or something.
Yeah.
I can sort of get under their skin, and once I'm there, it's much easier. In fact, it's in some ways it's too easy. It's a very glib way of writing. I'm now trying to draw back a little bit and reassert
really?
My authorial presence a little more. Uh-huh. I think it may be too subtle for a reader to notice, but I can
tell.
Oh,
gotcha. Well, I actually wanted to actually ask you, you have a really great panache in this book in particular about writing about really inept men.
It's my speciality.
Yeah. Jackson Brody and Martin are, you know, really, I think, the strongest and most fully formed characters in this book. And
oh, really? Because yeah. I think the women are. It's interesting that.
Well, it's because I suppose, again, it's going back to this whole notion of perspective. I'm wondering how you feel in terms of, like, do you feel that you write... I got the sense that these men were more meaningful than the woman. Do you find it easier to write men or women?
Oh, I don't feel that at all. Actually, no, I feel quite the opposite. But men, I've only just started to write men.
Really?
They've been ciphers previously, or they've been dead, or they've been, you know, in wars, or they've been useless, but they've never really been men. And I think that Martin and Jackson have kind of split off. I think they're one man who's split in two. There's the sort of the manly man and the wimpy man, you know, the kind of a geeky guy.
Yeah.
And in a way, they're two halves of a man. So for me, Martin isn't so much a man. It was more like, what would it feel like? Because I was thinking, I can't imagine being a man. I can't imagine the pressures there are on being a man. I think it must be really hard. So what must it be like to be like a really geeky guy who's just not successful in any way? That must be terrible because the pressure on you is always to be manly in some way, you know? So that was, from that point of view, he was like a failed man.
Yeah.
And yet he's a full human being. And I kind of started from a point of sort of being very sorry for him. Whereas Jackson is really a woman in male disguise.
But he does actually do, I mean... some men I know actually do pine for specific things like the ankle, you know, in a woman. I mean, it was very, very, very specific things about Jackson that made me go, Jesus, she's got, like, this guy totally on the nose, you know?
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. But I think, you know, someone said to me the other day, he never wins a fight. And I thought, you're right. He's going to have to win a fight in order to maintain his masculine status here.
You know, the fact that you have pointed out to me that you do this sort of continuous sort of first draft, particularly on the first 100 pages, and this brings us to Martin, this kind of character who is like, you know, basically, you know, dragged through the coals of hell as he's trying to sort of, you know, figure this out. And it reminds me very much of the manner in which T.C. Boyle writes, where he writes very similarly, continuous first draft, and he's a bit of a narrative sadistic kind of guy. I was wondering, do you find a certain kind of pleasure in dragging your characters through the mud, or do you feel that this is a way for you to kind of understand them more? Like, for example, Martin, he's at that point where he's like, he's just... You know, when is this guy going to react to all this nonsense, you know?
There isn't much to be done with characters to whom only good things happen. There is no doubt about that. But I did want him to experience some kind of terrible fall, and not a fall from grace or a fall from a high point, but just a gradual fall from this middle point into an even worse point. I felt he had to somehow experience that, and I don't know why, because it is a kind of character cruelty, and you know, there are things that happen that are redeeming, but they tend to, they're more in my imagination and off the page at the time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I actually did feel at the end, I really put him through the ringer and didn't give him anything as a reward, which was a shame because he's a good guy.
Well, on the other hand, he has the successful career as an author. Although, at the same time, I was wondering if the cozies that he was writing was modeled off of any one specific or anything.
I must say no to that.
Huh. You must say no. That's not necessarily... Yeah, okay.
I must say no to that.
Careful
it answer. It was really... I mean, it was... He is a made-up character. Everyone thinks it's some kind of Romana Clay, you know,
yeah.
especially because of where I live and
yeah,
so on.
Course.
But not at all. It did come from my... Just from me, I guess. Well, I enjoyed writing that anyway. I would like to do a very small Nina Ryler mystery that lives on as an appendage in a book in the future,
I think,
in a reprint.
That's exactly what T.C. Boyle did with Talk Talk.
Oh, really?
I didn't
know that.
Yeah, he actually, well, originally he had an appendix of the novel that one of the characters
uh-huh.
was written on. So it's like,
oh, well,
the two were actually sort
yeah.
of like, guys are separated at
this
birth
my
or something.
Mentor.
Yeah, exactly. going back to this, you know, what's an Edinburgh writer writing about an Edinburgh writer, out of curiosity?
Oh, I know it's a little bit self-referential in
yeah.
some ways, but not really because he's nothing like me, and you know, and what happens to him is clearly nothing like me. But I like writing about writing and writers, and you get these very sniffy critics who say, oh, you know, writers shouldn't write about writing because it's so self-referential and so narcissistic. But not at all. Why shouldn't you? It's the thing you know best, as in some ways. And everything that everyone says to him has been said to me, so
yeah.
you know, it was a good place to put those comments in some ways, but. It was what he had to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. Okay.
And also because there is an element of pastiche running throughout the book, and somehow having that in as another level gave it something else, you know.
I actually wanted to ask you, too, about there is so much technology in this book.
Technology?
I mean, yes, there's a lot of it. It's like you have all these characters. It's like I almost got the sense that you would just recently... you know, submerged yourself into iPods and...
Oh, really?
And
webs,
because it's all over the place
is
in this
it?
Book. Like eBay, iPods,
yeah.
cell phone.
I hadn't even noticed.
I was wondering if like, you know, you were writing this, like, ooh, there's all this stuff on the internet. Or I don't know. I mean,
no, I'm very geared up, so it's just natural. I hadn't noticed that at all.
Well, okay, then let's talk about the Honda man. I was wondering why you chose a Honda, because a Honda is not a particularly threatening vehicle.
Well, that's why he chose it, too,
yeah.
because...
Yeah.
This is a man in disguise. I don't drive. This is why I realize I can't ever live in America, because I don't drive. I don't need to drive where I live, and
yeah.
also I have a big thing against cars. And so when it comes to writing about cars, my son-in-law is a driver.
Mm-hmm.
He runs a driving business. Cars are his life. Cars are entirely his life. So I phone him up and I go, so I've got this guy, and he's like a, you know, he's a really nerdy guy, and he's, you know, but he's got an income level of this, and this is what he does, and I want him to look like this, and so what's he going to drive? And he'll immediately go, you know, Honda Civic or
yeah.
whatever. So he's my car guy. He knows, he understands.
Yeah.
So in a way, the cars come from him. You know, I'll go, you know, I need a hairdresser's car, and he'll go, you know.
Do you have, like, car guys or... you know, realty property guys.
No, I just have the one car guy.
Do you have? I mean, how
I have a, I have lawyer guys. I have policeman guys. I have kind of special forces guys. I have army guys. I'm lining them up a little bit. But,
really?
Okay. They're all people I know.
Huh.
I let them take me out to lunch occasionally, and they're so you know kind of excited by this fact that they just let me have information.
The secret
sorts
of yeah. So for this whole situation, in terms of you don't really do research, you kind of like submerge yourself in the book and then like call your guys, so to speak.
Well, the thing is, you know, you people do say to me, do you do a lot of research with books? And I always go, no, I don't do any, because when you're online all the time, you forget that you research all the time, because of course as soon
yeah.
as I think, what would that be, you just look it up, and it doesn't feel like research anymore, so that I do research probably all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't notice.
Do you think that, you know, writing in a sort of online environment where you have Google, you can Google something, versus like
so
writing
lazy.
Like, you know, 10 years ago.
10 years
you know,
ago, you'd
yeah.
go to the public library and
yeah.
look something up in the reference. Oh, no, I really am going to miss all this when it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really going to miss technology.
Okay. Well, I wanted to actually ask, you're also a playwright in addition to a novelist. Do you find any advantage in any particular
I've
form?
Only written one play, really.
Oh, okay.
I've written a short play, but I've written a long play.
Okay.
And so, and because it was, for me, it was an apprentice piece, so
uh-huh.
therefore, I mean, I'd like to write another one, because obviously, you know, if you have one child, you know, you'd waste the possibility of doing it right the second time, and so I would like to have to write another play, but I don't ever think of myself as a playwright
okay.
at all. I think of myself as someone who could learn to write better plays.
Sure.
Really. So no, I don't. The thing that writing the play did for me was it taught me to write dialogue, because before that I really had very little dialogue in my books, and I didn't really believe in dialogue. And I also didn't have faith in it. I didn't see how dialogue could convey, you know, if he says, you know, that's a nice car, how can you just leave it at that and not say, he said with an ironical twist of his mouth, you know, I mean, I needed to give all the information about everything that was being said, so therefore I avoided the dialogue because it's better just to write the prose. But it was a very hard lesson to, because I remember saying to my director when I was kind of starting to write, I said, but it's just dialogue. Yeah. And he's going, yes, that's what a play is. And I'm going, right, okay. But it taught me to have faith that a reader can read the kind of the emptiness of dialogue, you know, intelligently, I think.
There's also one other factor to this that's interesting in light of your approach to novels, and that is that, you know, I'm a playwright too, but, you know, when you write a play, you have to fit within a very, like a screenplay or even a regular play, you have to fit within a very specific structure.
Mm.
And with novels, it's not so much the case. I'm wondering if both the play and this kind of, like, you know, mystery sort of genre novel, which is very plot heavy, if this is a way for you to kind of confine some of these natural sort of ebullient sort of tendencies of yours.
No, I don't think in terms of how long or how much structure or anything like, because it's kind of what it is. It's always how it is, so it kind of dictates itself. I know that's incredibly nebulous and vague, but I'm always aware of the structure of it, but it the writing itself dictates it in some way. I am more contained than I used to be, and I do step outside it more than I used to do, I think.
Yeah.
And look at it from, I try to look at it from a reader's point of view, you know, and read it, because it's very difficult to do that, because writing and reading are completely different activities. I think people somehow think they're related, but they're not at all. There's no relationship between writing and reading at all. So I do try more to step outside the structure and look at it and see how it feels, but even then I never entirely feel like you can ever do that.
Well, it's interesting, because I had read an interview that you had done with the Post-Dispatch in which you had said that, you know, reading while you were working on a novel is this really sort of thing that interferes with the writing. Maybe we can talk about the relationship you have between reading and writing, and how reading actually does interfere with the writing process, or vice versa. Is it more of a distraction, or do you fear that the voice will itself imprint itself upon your current work?
I think this part of the fear is reading something that you know is better than what you're writing.
Oh.
So you don't want to do that. You know, there is a bit of a thing about the voice, but actually I don't think that's ever happened with me. But it's really just, you know, you're working all day on words. Do you really want to then do words the rest of the time? It's like what I would like to do when I'm really engaged with the book is just to look at a tree, really. So, but it tends to take the form of looking at television. I just want to look at something that's not words, because that's what you're doing all day. And I think that's, and I mean, I'm really glad I read most of world literature before the age of 21, because I would never have time for it now or have the inclination for it, I think. That, you know, I did my reading when I had the space, and now I don't have that kind of space. Because I think, I was saying this to myself the other day, I was sitting here thinking, I really don't read a lot.
Yeah.
And I look on it as something that's bottom of the list of all the things that have to be done, or, you know, as a kind of guilty pleasure. Or maybe something for an hour on Sunday morning, you think, you read a bit of a book and you think, oh, you know, how exciting. It really should be part of my job. I mean, I do get quite a lot read, and I'm never sure how I do it. I think it's mainly planes and trains and airports, and, you know, I'm really getting through the books on this trip. But I just, it ceased to be high on my list, and I recognize that now as being a bad thing.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you something specific to jump off of this, but, Well, I wanted to actually ask about, you were talking about sort of categorizing books into like sort of guilty pleasure versus literary, and this brings up an interesting question. Some reviewers, including The Guardian's Justine Jordan, have called One Good Turn a romp, which is interesting in light of the fact that like Sarah Waters' books are often called romps. And I was wondering, you know, is a romp the kind of the new literary sort of genre? What do you feel that this is a romp, or, you know, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would never call a book a romp.
I mean, why is there a pejorative to a romp? That's what I'm wondering.
It's not necessarily a pejorative term. It carries with it, it's a bit like jolly, it carries with it a certain kind of esprit, you know, that's, but at the same time it means it's not serious literature. So, you know, you are damned by your, damned by the praise in a way, I think. So, I don't know, romp, it's a good word, isn't it? It's an interesting word to use. Yeah.
It's a very, double entendre sort
it's
of.
It's very much, it does contain the pejorative within it.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's hard to condemn the person for saying it,
yeah.
But then, reviewers.
I'm just wondering if in the UK sort of atmosphere of books that, here in the States, we have this whole thing of like, yes, the National Book Awards recently were not announced, and there were several genre books in there in terms of like, oh, well, things are kind of starting to become
Oh,
like,
no, we don't reward genre books. Yeah. No. In fact, my agent said to me the reason I wasn't on the book along list was because they regarded it as a genre book.
Wow,
so,
really?
Yeah, we're very snobby about books. I mean, you could, the French, they don't think like that, and the Americans less so than the Brits. The British like to put people in boxes. They really, really do. And if they can't put you in a box, they don't like you because you're frightening.
Now, I found it interesting because I know the original title for this book was Jolly Murder Mystery, which was then added as a subtitle to the UK edition, but there is no trace of it anywhere in the US edition. What happened with this?
I don't know. Americans just couldn't handle the word jolly, apparently.
I don't know.
It doesn't exist in any other country either as a subtitle.
Really?
So, yeah,
okay.
It's only in Britain that... Well, I insisted because when they said they wanted to change the title to come in line with the American title,
yeah.
Because the Americans changed the title, because, and I understand why, because Jolly Murder Mystery doesn't travel well. I mean, no other countries use that title, and the British publishers wanted to come in line so as to avoid confusion. I was very put out and threw a little hissy fit and said, well, only if I can retain it as a subtitle. So that's why it's still there, because for me, for Britain, it's a perfect title. It just runs, it's great, but it doesn't work anywhere else, so.
Is Jolly Murder Mystery sort of a way for you to kind of, I guess, take back the murder mystery, take back all putting these books into boxes? Is Jolly, is this kind of rompish, or is this literary-ish, or I mean, what?
I mean, it is something that Martin, the writer, has said to him in a pejorative term,
sure.
It's just a jolly murder mystery. So I thought in a term, well, it's quite a good thing, because there is a, it's not an entirely serious book. It's not as sad and emotional as Case Sisters. At the same time, I wouldn't call it a romp, but the deaths that are in it aren't treated as jolly, because no murder is, no true murder is in any way possibly jolly. So I think it's very interesting that the Brits really want to turn, the whole kind of Agatha Christie kind of genre of books into something that's highly amusing and, so on, because it's not.
Yeah.
So the amusement factor in this book, in my book, is around the idea of murder, but it's never connected with murder itself.
Yeah.
I just find it a curious term,
sure.
Because it's clearly such a, so antithetical. I don't know.
Well, it also kind of comes at the crux of something that is a recurrent sort of, feeling in this book. Like, for example, Richard Maud is a character for some strange reason I enjoyed immensely, even though he was a complete bastard.
Yes, I dislike him intensely.
Yeah, but you made him strangely appealing.
I know.
It's like, I mean, but this goes to a question I wanted to ask you about empathy. I would contend, and I would argue, that in this book and in Case History is the way that you kind of, the mode that you have the reader sympathize or empathize with these characters is because there's this kind of nuanced empathy. And I was wondering, as you were writing this, you were sort of implying earlier that, okay, what I'm doing here, I just feel it's right. But I mean, are you very conscious of this kind of empathetic sort of thrust that is there that allows the readers to kind of feel for these characters?
I think with characters, what I dislike when I'm reading a book is a character that I cannot empathize with on any level.
Okay.
Just, really, that you just can't get a key to at all.
Yeah.
I really hate characters like that in movies as well.
Yeah.
And so that if I'm going to write a character, there has to be something there that's somehow redeeming. And sometimes with characters who I start off with who I don't like and I don't want to be nice characters, I do find that they get softened up because characters are ciphers for real people, and as well as, being constructs that you're using within a construct, they do represent in some way reality. And there are very few people who are 100%, unlikable. Most people have some, I say that and I'm immediately thinking, I know lots of people who have no redeeming characteristics, but I think, that there has to be something there. And that's really from my point of view. So you're never really sure how people feel about your characters, although they do tend to seem to feel the same way you do about them. And that's one of the mysteries of writing, isn't it? How it translates. So it's not that I do it purposefully, it's just that that's how they develop for me, I think.
I wanted to ask you also about, like, this book kind of came really quickly off of the, you know, I mean, for a laborious and for a very sort of carefully kind of crafted narrative, this came less than 2 years after, you know, Case Histories did. And I'm wondering...
I know, it was quite quick, but Case Histories was really quick to write. I wrote it in about 6 months, and I came off it, and I thought, I'll just keep on, because this would be so easy. And then I thought, no, I mustn't do that. And I spent a year writing another book. I always have about a year writing this other book, and it's always the same book. I have about 120 pages of it. I really have to finish it next time.
Yeah.
And then I went back and wrote this one. And, you know, I put Jackson Brody into it again. And if I had gone straight on, it would have been like Case Histories 2, whereas in fact what I wanted to do was to revisit the character in a different way, so that he's only one of four main characters, and the time frame is very tight. And I wanted to write a novel that had interwoven storylines, much more so than the last one. So the last one was very much three separate storylines, and have a different feel, not have that kind of emotional heart that Case Histories has. I didn't want to write that. I mean, and everyone wants Case Histories too, of course. You know, you just get the same old stuff coming from people, like, well, it's not quite Case Histories because, you know, after Behind the Scenes, everyone wanted another Behind the Scenes. And, you know, obviously you're not going to do that as a writer. You want to do different things. And it's only after writing the other book again. I've been doing the same book I always write and then abandon for another year now, that I realised that, you know, the rule of three is very strong, and I think I probably will make this a trilogy and then be able to put an end to it for a while so I can move on to, you know, something else. And so now I'm thinking, well, how do I make it different then? What is there about it? The horror of doing something that just feels the same, because it's not going to entertain me.
Sure.
Maybe other people would like it, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you take any sort of steps to constantly challenge yourself to make each book different?
Not consciously, it just happens. And sometimes I just sit there when I'm writing and thinking, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this to myself? Because this is too difficult.
Sure.
But, no, not consciously. Just make, you know, it's what you're looking for, isn't it? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. You would think that, you know, you were sort of suggesting that there's this interference, like, come on, Kate, you can give us another behind
just,
the scenes.
It's one of my many voices.
Yeah.
That's Team Kate, you know.
Do they have sort of short-term memory, or is this why you have to keep cranking out the books to sort of show, yes, there are different books here from Kate Atkinson?
It's interesting that I always wonder why one sets oneself any kind of challenge when life would be so much easier if you didn't.
Sure.
Yeah.
But then you wouldn't have this kind of sort of, you know, this exuberance that is burgeoning from book to book to book, you know?
Oh, I don't know, but because you don't feel exuberant when you're writing.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that it will come out of that artifact because, you know, it's something that you've put together.
Yeah.
So I find that curious as well, the kind of the ambience of a book.
Yeah. What steps do you do to kind of keep the book writing process fun? Because it's like, you know, having to go ahead and sit and look at the blank page is not a fun prospect. And yet, the prospects of, I mean, in this book, there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of enjoyment going on.
I think you have to, I don't know. I think not writing is a way of getting the writing back. Okay, so I do spend an incredible amount of time pottering around in my house. But also because I know I won't get any of that pottering done once I start writing.
Yeah.
So just really not thinking too much is a way of getting out of that kind of, you know. But I actually found that writing stories was a great antidote to writing novels. When I wrote Not the End of the World, it was after three long, well, to me, long books that had really drained me, and I didn't want to ever write again at all. I just say I really haven't enjoyed, especially the Emotionally Weird. I found that really, really hard, and I did say to my publishers, I just need to get joy back into this. And so I'm going to write stories. And they were, of course, like, oh, must she? Oh, we must humor her. You know, why must they write stories, these writers? They don't sell.
I get the sense that no matter what you would decide upon, they would resist it or something.
They really didn't want the stories. But they got the stories. And I really enjoyed writing stories. I mean, I do enjoy writing. I've always enjoyed writing stories since I started writing. So I was really surprised at how much pleasure I got from them. And I thought, oh, that's good. And that's what made me just kind of start again with Case Histories and in a really different frame of mind, and that's why it wrote so quickly, was because I'd enjoyed writing the stories before it. So I kind of think, well, if I did another book with Jackson Brody in, then, you know, maybe that would be, I've got to finish the book I always start, obviously, but then that would be a good time to write stories and reunite me with why you write. And I don't know why you write, so there's no answer to that, but yeah. To get that kind of sense of pleasure out of sitting down with a structure and looking at it and being able to control it. I'm very Jamesian about the short story. I mean, yeah. I do think it is all about control, and you can only exercise control in the short form. In the long form, it's too big. It's more than you, you know. And I think that's part of the angst of the writing process, is that it's so big. So sure. When you have something that you have absolute control over, and it's almost physically, you know, you can see it. That's, to me, is actually very pleasurable, which makes me sound like an incredibly anally retentive person. But, you know, I like that sense of order that you get from the story.
We have to get you out of here, but I will ask you one final question, sort of a big one. Going back to the sense of order, one of the things about this book that was interested me is that you sort of impute that the act of sort of like, you know, being polite or the act of detecting is often at odds with the sort of, you know, the natural flow of the world. And it's almost as if you have this kind of larger sort of thematic bucket to capture all of these really, you know, interesting observations and these interesting sort of characters. And I'm wondering if theme is as much of an important part of your work as plot or as these characters. Do you need to have some really overarching, large kind of sense of the importance of writing before you actually sat down to write a book? Or is this something I'm observing that you may not have been conscious of? I don't know.
No, I don't sit down with a theme, except for Human Croquet. I wanted to write about trees, which really alarmed my publisher, I have to say. But with this one, I knew that it was about greed and money. And the natural child of that is bad behavior. And it is, I mean, this is par excellence in a novel about bad behavior. There's no doubt about that. So it was quite interesting because it did give me somewhere to channel my, because I am Gloria in this book. I mean, she's the character who's closest to me, and she is very, very conscious of good and bad behavior. And also the morality of that, because, you know, she says, you know, is it actually wrong to kill someone?
Sure.
And is it wrong to thieve? And obviously the answer is, you know, not in the right circumstances. So although she's a very moral character, her morality doesn't, and her ethics don't necessarily comply with society's, and sure. I guess that's sort of how I feel myself. But I think, in a way, it's very Austenite. You know, it's very like Jane Austen, in that good behavior is rewarded and bad behavior is punished, and that's how I would like the world to be.
Yeah.
So yes, it's a kind of there is a certain element of wish fulfillment, I think, about all books in a way. But in this one in particular, I think it's there's almost that the rigidity of the fairy tale structure here, you know, that, you know, justice will prevail.
So really it was a sense of kind of ethical justice that was kind of one of the motivating thrusts of the book.
I think because that came through the character Gloria, and I had Gloria for quite a long time. She was in the other book I was writing to begin with, and so I understood that for me the moral and the heart center of this book is Gloria. Mm-hmm. So and you know, and that's so important to her, that the way people behave, that, you know, it was a kind of a big thrust in the novel.
And yet some people actually get away with certain things, I mean, without revealing anything.
Oh yes, but so I say, you know, there is a morality that's not necessarily the greater morality. It's more of a utilitarian kind of morality. And there are characters who are out and out criminals, really, who get away with things. But I like those characters, so they're allowed.
Okay, one last question and we'll go. But the Honda Man is this kind of like, you even describe the character as like coming out of a movie or being a golem, you know? And I was curious about this because it's like, he seems to me sort of one-dimensional guy who comes up, here's the guy with the baseball bat.
Yeah, he is. And in a way, that was his function. I was never tempted to make him into a fully rounded character.
Yeah, I was wondering about this. Why not?
Well, because he's not the truly evil character in the book.
Yeah.
The evil takes other forms. He is just like cartoon evil.
Yeah.
And yes, he does kill people, but that's neither here nor there in the book. It's the people behind him who are the evil people. You know, it is the dark forces that we know not of, as our own dear Queen said. And I think, you know, that's the kind of morality that underpins the book. It's not necessarily the guys who look like the bad guys who are the bad guys.
Well, Kate, thank you so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
And you. Thank you.
So.